We have Robert Rowley, who is a, he works for what I understand is TrustWave in their Spider Labs division. Is that right? I don't want to get anybody in trouble here. So, and he's going to talk about detecting and defending against state actor surveillance, which, as we all know, you know, certainly in the past couple of years, we all know for sure that the state is as much a threat as a lot of the other threats that are out there. So, hey, let's give a big party track. Welcome to Robert.
All right, thank you all for showing up at this 1 o'clock. I'm certain most of you have just woken up. Hold on, let me turn on my notes. Yeah, definitely thank you for choosing the presentation. I'm going to be talking about detecting the surveillance tools that state actor surveillance groups are using. It's an extension of a series of blog posts that I posted earlier this year to the Spider Labs blog, blog.spiderlabs.com. It details how to detect and defend against the state actor surveillance tools that were released earlier, late last year, 2013. Foremost is, who is this guy, right? I'm Robert Rowley. My day job is working as a security researcher for TrustWave. I work in their Spider Labs division, the Spider Labs department. I specifically do vulnerability assessment. That's not really what, there's not a lot of crossover between what this talk is about and my actual day job. I pretty much write Ruby code all day long, and this is really not specific to the work that I do, but it's a great example about the organization that I work for and how they allow me to kind of basically run on my own to do my own independent research, and they're willing to let me have their name on these slides, which is quite amazing. I've been part of the Southern California hacker scene. I've been going to DEF CON since DEF CON 9. I've been going part of the Southern California hacker scene for 10 plus years. I feel very old, but I really started doing all this when I was 14 or 15 years old, choosing a Linux computer instead of a car. Yeah. Thank you. I was stuck at home a lot, and I got a lot of walking in. You can hit me up on Twitter at @iamlei, @iamlei. You can hashtag harass me all you want. I don't care. You can do it during, after, whatever. But again, back to me, is I was identified as a security researcher now as a formal title, but years and years ago, it was somebody else told me that I was a security researcher after some fun shenanigans I had here at DEF CON, where I'm actually the guy that's responsible for that free cell phone charging kiosk at the Wall of Sheep. So anybody's battery's dead, please feel free to go to the Wall of Sheep, charge your phone for free. I swear, it's all on the up and up. On a good note, though, I'm probably, because of that charging station, I'm probably the reason why the paid charging station that was also here at the Rio the first year that I did the malicious one, I'm probably the reason why that thing is gone. I don't think it lasted the weekend. I've been given a lot of presentations about, you know, cell phone stuff, some web stuff, a lot of crazy stuff. This is completely different. It's just kind of a tie-in to some kind of pseudo-activism stuff that I've also been kind of associated with. I've talked with some activist groups like Restore the Fourth down in Southern California. I like what they do. They do things that I can't do, but I can't do alone. I care a lot about privacy. It's always been a concern of my own you know, personal concerns. And especially after what happened in the last year or so, we kind of escalated everything. I've been interested in privacy, though, for about 4 or 5 years. In fact, it goes back to about 10 years, and I'll get into that story. I'll just go ahead and get into that. Go on. I should also take note, everybody here, I have a thing that I don't like: hearsay. Hearsay is a story with no tangible evidence. It's something that you heard from a third party or heard from a second party or you feel like happened, but you don't have any tangible evidence to back up your story. I really loathe how that is. I do appreciate somebody who can show me evidence as opposed to somebody who just says, this is how it is, this is how I think it is. There's a lot of this going around, mostly not with necessarily this community so much, and DEF CON hacking, technical oriented people. You guys all have logical mindset where you know how things add up and how things work, but I see a lot in the activist groups, especially LA, Southern California area, where there's a lot of, this is how I feel things happen. I really feel sad. But going on to this talk, I'm going to cover a couple of categories of the surveillance catalog. I've kind of explained the introduction already. I'm going to give a quick kind of like an introduction, explain some things, kind of give some backstory on some things. Then I go into the talk about the detailed information in the surveillance catalog leaks, which is what I'm calling it. It's the TAO release from alleged NSA top secret documents. For anybody here who has a security clearance that may be worried about me leaking the security clearance information, I have you covered. I'll explain it in a bit. Don't worry, you will not have any risk of seeing any top secret documents leaked here. But yeah, basically the documents were released at 30C3 last year in 2013 by a researcher, journalist, person who explained how everything was. I looked into them, and I'll get into more specifics on it, but after they were released is when I started writing up the blog post, because that's kind of how I felt. Nobody was looking at it as, let's find evidence for this. So I wanted to give people information on how you find evidence for these things, so how you detect against them, so you know you are or are not being spied upon. Yeah, it's all the focus on the talk is to detect how to find the tangible evidence. The talk is not peddling snake oil, which is key. I'm not trying to sell you a service or anything like that. I'm not trying to buy you a safety net from evil aliens, the Illuminati, or the Owl Farm. Any other controllers of the universe, anybody who's reading your thoughts or minds, I'm not trying to protect you from those guys. You just need to seek out psychotherapy. So, foremost, let's understand who is involved in this matter. These are surveillance states. They're looking at what people are doing. People don't feel good about that. So there are spies and those that are spied on. Simple. Spies can spy on other spies, but those are two factors in this matter. Somebody's either listening in or somebody's being listened to. People gather intelligence. They spy on other agencies that gather intelligence. It's about how they use the intelligence and the information that they're gathering for good or evil. Remember, folks, it's he who wins wars that writes the history books. I've actually been spied upon in my life. This is really where the core of my ideals and activism works. I believe it was I like to call it a scare and care that happened in 2001, 2002, right after certain events in this country that allowed the agency that was doing the spying to look into everything that I was doing at the time, and I was aware of this because they weren't really good at what they were doing at that time. They came up to my house, they asked for the name on the DSL bill, which was my grandmother, because I was living at my grandmother's house. So they assumed that she was the individual who was responsible for all this activity on the network. So they sat down with her in the living room with their guns on their side, just nice, happy, you know, well-dressed agents. They had guns on them, and they sat down with my grandmother, and they talked with her for 15, 20 minutes, probably only 5 minutes. I wasn't around for that, but they saw a laptop on her dining room table, and they just assumed. It was her laptop that I bought her so she can play solitaire, so she wouldn't have to shuffle. They just assumed. And then I heard my grandma call. And I came out and said, hello. And they said, oh, that you're who we're looking for. Little 18-year-old me. Eventually, those agents, I follow them. So I hope if he's here, I'll love to talk to you again if you remember that story and remember who I am. So again, like I said, it's all about who spies. Why do spies spy? So spies can spy for good, or they can spy for evil. It's what they do with it. But reality is they spy as a job. They justify their actions as for greater good, or for better words, what's what their duty is. It's their job. If they don't spy right, or they don't spy enough, it's their job. They lose their job, they lose their money, they lose their family, their house, etc., so forth. So you have to understand it's not necessarily inherently good. It's just whether or not they have the morality in their own soul to say this is wrong and tell people about how it's wrong or refuse to do that work. Find other work. To take from my previous slide, it's about he who wins wars writes the history books. Alan Turing is a good example of somebody who did a great thing, and he was breaking encryption. He was spying on what was at the time the Axis powers, and using his math, using his knowledge to break their encryption protocols to be able to listen to their stuff. He did bad if you look at it from the Axis point of view. He did great if you look at it from the Allied point of view, and coincidentally, Allies won World War II. Post-war, we all know how he was treated, and we know how that works. So again, it's when you're valuable, you're invaluable, and when you're no longer valuable, they'll treat you just like they were originally. History is always being written, though. We're at a very interesting time right now. There's a lot of current events. Who here knows what's going on, like all the current events? Is surveillance state fear a new thing for anybody here? I highly recommend actually looking back all the way to the 70s. Most of the stuff that we see today is just a repeat of many similar things that were happening back in the 1970s, which is when there was a great overhaul in privacy laws in the United States. But look back, I'm not gonna dwell too much on that. I'll just go ahead and go on. Full disclosure, again, I loathe tinfoil hat wearers. People come up to me with crazy whimsical stories after I've given this or similar talks, and they talk about how the Illuminati came in and blackbagged their girlfriend. By the way, hint, hint, she's just not returning your calls. I can't help you if you don't have physical evidence. In fact, I'm frankly, to be honest, not really interested unless you have physical evidence. I'm very interested if you have physical evidence and you can show me something that was happening. To date, nobody's come forward based on these leaks and actually shown physical evidence of one of these bugs existing or having been found. To go in, though, there's a story here. In 2010, well before this information was released, and what I'm going to be talking about today, there was an individual who did write up a story. They contacted Wired.com, and one of their publishers published a story about how they found a GPS tracking device in their car. So this has happened. It's just not related to the leaks that we're talking about. So it has happened. This information is out there. You could probably find it if you look. You just have to know. If you see something that doesn't belong, unplug it, see if a black SUV shows up, and some guys in suits try to talk to you. Yeah, this is the only major story that I found. I'm familiar with it because it was from Southern California, which is where I'm from. It's basically the only thing that has evidence. It's the only thing I was aware of that had evidence. Obviously, nobody accepts or admits involvement to it. So that's what you can expect in the end. But what happened was there was actually a Wired article and something tangible was presented and discussed in the public arena, which was a great thing. So getting into the beef now, what is the surveillance catalog? As I mentioned before, something written up by a presenter, a journalist, a researcher, 30C3. It was released in Der Spiegel as well as during that conference kind of at the same time, right around just after Christmas 2013. Getting into the surveillance catalog leaks, yeah, Der Spiegel. They had lots of details on how they worked, kind of an idea. There's a lot of missing components. But what was most interesting was a lot of people alluded to assume what the source was Snowden. But the leaked information that was leaked was actually, the source was never credited. So it's unknown if it was directly related to the Edward Snowden leaks. What I can tell you is that from my knowledge of which reporters and news agencies have released information about Snowden first, Der Spiegel wasn't on that list. So they possibly never had the actual copy of Snowden's leaks, nor would they be going forward with this information while other ones were ignoring it. So you can consider that. There's been a lot of talk recently about this, considering maybe there's a second leaker. I don't know really what it is, either a second leaker, either it's information they had from perhaps a WikiLeaks type source or something like that, because we know there's connections with the researcher involved with it in WikiLeaks. So yeah, there basically is not necessarily Snowden. A lot of people like to say Snowden. It could be a second shooter or leaker. Maybe they're on the grassy knoll or through WikiLeaks. Let the conspiracy theories begin, but please keep them away from me. So this is what I promised earlier. I'm introducing a character called Surveillance Sam. This character, Surveillance Sam, is helping me avoid showing secret documents during the talk. It's also because when I thought about, how do I show the images that I don't own the copyright for because they're part of top secret documents, I didn't know if I could necessarily call the NSA and say, hey, can I use these in my slides? I just kind of assumed what their answer would be, so I took the appropriate action, created my own character. I think more people should be doing this. He's copyright free, everybody can have him. I've got stickers up here as well, and there's a vendor in the vendor area, Hacker Stickers, who also has the stickers available. So come see me. He comes with, obviously, as you can see, he comes with my special limited edition black helicopter and anti-whistleblower karate chop action. Thanks for listening to my spiel so far. Let's get into some actual details, all right? So information, we're gonna start, it's four sections. We're gonna start off with hardware bugs. After each section, feel free, if you have a question, raise your hand, go up to the podium, kinda hoot and whistle, try to figure me out. So I don't wanna jump back and forth if anybody had any specific questions. First, and again, the first introduction of, second introduction of now of Surveillance Sam, this is a series of hardware bugs. These are all called retro reflectors. RageMaster is a bug that attaches to your VGA cable, typically along the red data feed, It is used to transmit the data from your VGA cable's red feed to a remote source so they can kind of see what's on your screen. Loud Auto is basically an embedded microphone in systems. These have existed since the 60s and well before. A little miniature microphone that when an RF signal is sent to it, starts transmitting what it hears in the room. Same thing, TargeRyard is a radio beacon. Kind of think of it like this as RFID on crack. They can track down where a physical device is, maybe a laptop they've connected to a laptop or a phone. They can use radio beacons to try to find out where you are, hunt you down. Surly Spawn, similar to the Rage Master, is a system that's embedded in line with your keyboard now, and they transmit, when it sends an RF signal to turn it on, it starts transmitting what you're typing on your keyboard. Basic ideas here, very simple. They all collect information and send it over the RF frequencies, radio frequencies. Obviously, we know how to fix this is by wearing a tinfoil hat. You can go call the EFF and maybe get a limited edition tinfoil hat. By the way, not sponsored, not real. That was a joke. It wouldn't detect anything, and that's really not what the point of this talk is, again. So please don't actually think tinfoiling up your stuff will tell you if somebody was spying on you. It's a good thing as a deterrent, but it won't tell you somebody was doing anything. You'll be running around with a non-stylish hat, unless somebody figures that out and makes it cool. And you can... This actually tracks back to what I mentioned before, juice jacking. It's the malicious cell phone kiosks. It's something that I did a while ago, and everybody starts... It's gained a lot of popularity. It's been back in the news recently, just coincidentally. People are releasing these items called USB condoms and such, where it removes the data lines from your USB port so that you can charge freely. Again, this is a problem that I feel is if that prevents something, but it doesn't tell you that somebody was actually trying to get data off of your phone. Surprisingly enough, there's a solution for that. It's called plugging your phone in. It's kind of scary. But when you plug your phone in, if your phone, most phones, Android phones, iPhones, will tell you if it's trying to negotiate with a computer and if you want to access it. And that's the point in time. Perhaps plug in a burner phone you're not afraid to lose, or plug in another device. And then that's the point in time where you say, why the hell is there a CPU on the other end of this charging station? That's far more valuable to know than running around with a little USB condom, assuming every charging USB port out there is out to get you. For these bugs, though, the correct answer would be using a software-defined radio, something like the HackRF board by Michael Osman, Great Scott Gadgets. The software-defined radio is a great thing in recent years. Instead of buying a $10,000, $30,000, $100,000 piece of gear to listen to radio spectrums, you basically buy a small board. I don't know how much the HackRFs go for, but only a few hundred bucks, if that. You write software for them, and it will listen into the spectrums that you're trying to listen in on. If you sit there, you can figure out what the ambient radio noise in any room or office is, and simply listen for spikes or changes in this. When you see spikes or changes, perhaps it was associated when you were typing on your keyboard or when you had a computer on, and now you can start ruling out things and find out what the hell is going on. I was asked by a reporter if I had any software that I was releasing for this, or like a tool to detect the surveillance states. And I have to clarify here that because nobody has come forward with an actual tangible, here is what the NSA or CIA or any other group is actually using, it would be inappropriate to design a detection tool, because simply enough, you wouldn't know what frequencies they're listening on. It's either going to false positive or never detect it at all. And I'd be selling snake oil, which is not something I want to do. Which I guess a shout out though does go to the group who in your DEF CON schedule, you'll see the NSA playset talks. All of those guys are basically designing what the open source alternatives to these surveillance tools would be. So it's very interesting. Go find those talks, and perhaps then you can be the one that creates, or maybe I'll be the one that creates the detection tools just for the fun of it. But again, it won't actually work in real life. The surveillance states you can assume are not using what the, maybe they're not using the open source ones, or maybe the surveillance, or the NSA playset is just doing them a favor. It'd be funny. Moving on, another way for hardware bugs to work is data exfiltration methods or embedded compromising devices. For Cottonmouth, this is a USB bug. It embeds in your USB either hub, in your USB device, in your USB cable directly. And again, it's used for USB injections over an air link or an air gap. So it sends RF to this to start sending USB attacks onto a system. Ginsu, which is a PCI bus bug. Who here is familiar with IPMI? How much? 10%. So basically, IPMI is a control utility that is plugs into your PCI bus, and it lets you do basically anything to the box. You can remotely administer the box by plugging in this PCI PCI card. That's basically what Ginsu is. It's you know, just now it's tailored for surveillance state usage. HowlerMonkey, which is a series of RF transmitters. Basically, they don't specifically explain what they do, but HowlerMonkey transmits RF for other utilities. Firewalk is an Ethernet bug. It can inject and or monitor traffic, basically a packet sniffer or a packet injector. For these, or any of these devices, which connect to a JTAG, which is GodSurge, which is a BIOS attack system, compact flashcards, Star Montana systems, they all mean basically it's a method of persistent compromise on a device. You either attack the BIOS, you attack the peripherals. That's what all these devices are, and they all share one thing in common, that they can be found if you look for them. So if you look in a system and you see Surveillance Sam, you know there's something wrong. It means your kid has gotten into your computer. But more importantly, if you look into a system and you see a PCI card that perhaps you don't know what it does or why it's plugged in, and you unplug it, and that black SUV again shows up about an hour later, then you know you have something going on. Or if nothing breaks, perhaps you just want to leave it unplugged and not try to worry about it. Some of these systems plug into JTAG headers, which here Surveillance Sam is inspecting. It's right below them. JTAG headers are headers that basically, they're leads that go directly into a CPU. They're intended for usage on mostly embedded systems. They also, GodSurge, which was released in the NSA play, or the TAO catalog, was targeting a server from a certain vendor, which I probably shouldn't name to keep my job. But the idea is that, simply enough, they had leads that led, that they left it exposed on the board that when they shipped out, which is a very common thing for any vendor to do. It's used during debugging and development, during the board's basically debugging and development process. It allows you to basically get into the CPU to find out what went wrong. It's way easier to do it that way, especially for embedded devices that have no monitors or keyboard inputs. You just plug into the JTAG port. It's kind of like a serial interface directly to the CPU. In fact, it pretty much is, because it's slow as all. I'm trying to think of the right expletive to use. Fill in your blank. The key on detecting anything like this, you would assume that perhaps I'll never be able to detect something that's embedded into the system, is that remember that every vendor who ships a board is going to have every single PCB trace on the board. They aren't going to be running cables over the board to make connections that were hard to make because they didn't have enough layers. Pretty much everybody nowadays with the technology for PCB creation, they can make as many layers as they want. They'll pass the cost on to the consumer. This isn't the 1980s with the Apple II that you had to build yourself in a garage. Nobody has exposed leads, exposed wires. If you see one on a computer, perhaps you want to look up the manufacturer specs to see if that's connected to your CPU or to an existing JTAG or XDP or ITP header. That would be how you would find them. And again, how you find them is simply looking for the thing that doesn't belong. What I have here is two allergy pills and one laxative. And specifically their children's allergy medicine. So if you can't tell what's wrong, then perhaps you shouldn't also be a parent who may accidentally give your sick child a laxative pill, which doubles your problems. All right, let's move on to some software compromises. So software exploits basically attack firmware or BIOS. They aren't an embedded device, so you can't just open up your motherboard or open up your case and start looking inside for something that's creating the persistent compromise. What you would do is you would actually, let me explain what they are. Swap and irate monk are basically master boot record or hard drive firmware attacks. Interestingly enough, master boot record attacks have existed for years. Hard drive firmware attacks have been recently popularized at some other conferences. Wistful Toll, a deity bounce, or motherboard BIOS attacks. They rewrite your BIOS. There's been some talk about malicious BIOSes in the last year or so. And what's interesting is that the way they were detecting it, the way they were talking about it, I didn't see many people that were showing examples of the BIOS where, you know, that's basically what you would want to start looking at, start pulling off the data from the chip. It's very time consuming. It's very tedious. The fast way to do it is just reflash the devices. Unfortunately, it's really not going to tell you if anything was malicious on the device. You'd have to. The only way to do it, like I mentioned, is by pulling the firmware off of the device, finding a way to pull the BIOS off the device. Every device is going to be different, but pull that data, get a copy of the firmware from the manufacturer, try to talk to them to see if it was what you had expected to see, and then do comparisons. If there's something comes up, then now you know what's going on. Now you know there's something interesting going on, and you can start debugging it or decompiling it to see what's going on. Again, nobody really came forward with any BIOS-based malware found in the wild in the last year or so that actually explained this detailed and said, look, this is exactly where these attacks are. Another way that kind of saves it, the problem with doing that is that it's really, really slow to pull firmware off of a device. Normally it's like, I don't know, 900 baud or slower. It just feels like it takes forever. In this day and age where the internet is gigabits, something that's measured in basically bits, baud rate, is very sad. There's a platform module, basically a system chip called TPM, Trusted Platform Module. Who here is familiar with how they work? Not many. Who here is familiar with how to hack them? Huh? Even less. One guy over there. Thank you. Somebody. I had somebody yell at me last time I gave something. Last time I mentioned TPM, he just sat there shaking his head, disappointed as to what I was talking about. But the reality is, let me explain. Trusted Platform Module is a chip that holds a crypto key, a private key, and it securely holds that key so it cannot be pulled off. There are attacks against it where you can basically tear apart the chip and start pulling the data off the chip, and you'll be able to get the key, but that requires physical and destructive actions. You'll know something's wrong when you see that your chips are being desoldered using acids and other systems. If somebody needs to borrow your laptop and is handing it back to you wearing a hazmat suit, you have something to be concerned about. It's gotten a lot of flack from the security community, mostly because manufacturers enjoy using TPM to lock down hardware. They prevent changes to hardware. They'll be able to detect changes in hardware. They'll be able to detect changes in your device. And, well, hackers don't like that because we want to change things. We want to modify stuff. We want to not be punished for doing that. What's funny is the inverse of this is that we can use TPM to detect changes in devices. We can use TPM to detect changes in firmware because it's a secured key that anytime something changes, we can know that, you know, something changed. We need to look into this. It does it automatically. It does it much faster than physically pulling the firmware off of a device. The problem with it, though, is that it's only ever as good as it's been implemented. Most manufacturers do not implement TPM correctly. There are attacks against it, and as you can see in this picture, which I took when I was out in the desert, sometimes people don't understand security. They think putting a lock on it works. In this case, it wouldn't work for shit. I got to see what was inside that shed. It was a lot of rat poop. I think some paint cans. So let's talk a little bit about Wi-Fi. There are two devices. Who here has a Wi-Fi pineapple? Very good. You basically have exactly what this TAO playset was explaining. Except for one of them is attached to a UAV or an airplane, or in this case, the Special Edition Surveillance SAM Black Helicopter. Nightstand is effectively a Wi-Fi pineapple, nothing special. But instead, it looked like it was a laptop in a case that looked like it opened up and probably just has a series of Wi-Fi-based attacks that you can use. Sparrow was a simple, very small form factor. It's a Wi-Fi device attached to a drone. You would use all of your same common sense with all of the Wi-Fi attacks that have existed for the last 10, 15 years to be able to detect these devices listening in on you or detect those devices in your area. If you have a Wi-Fi pineapple, it's a good thing. If you don't know what a Wi-Fi pineapple is, you're probably going to be compromised for this. These types of attacks, so just turn Wi-Fi off unless you need it. There's not much more I can say here, not to get into too much details or not to spin off an entire talk about Wi-Fi-based attacks, so I'm just going to quickly skip over it. Cellular networks is the final section. I think I'm going pretty good pace, a little bit fast, so if anybody has any questions, again, feel free to let me know. Cellular networks are the final group where I'm, again, now making a large jump from the basic hardware-based attacks. Cell phone bugs, easy to say that we all rely on cell phones. I'm very familiar with people who rely on cell phones, especially with the work that I did before. Any surveillance agency is going to be pushing to detect and monitor these cell phones and cell phone networks. It's just what they do. I should say, too, that I forgot to mention earlier that I found a sense of pride when the research that I released many years ago with the malicious cell phone charging kiosk actually ended up in a government document as to how to protect yourself while traveling abroad. So I apparently have also helped save the state by letting them know to let their their top operatives and government agents not charge cell phones when they're flying into China or Russia. Perhaps that free cell phone charging kiosk at the embassy isn't a good idea. It wasn't such a nice present. But none of the information released in the TAO catalog included malicious cell phone charging kiosks, so I kind of felt sad. None of that information got leaked. I will be adding, because I talked to Michael Osman a little while ago, I will be adding the juice jacking device and some software for it to the NSA playset, which is what he's releasing here at DEF CON. It's a series of tools that are all open source, so I'm going to actually be releasing that, so somebody at least has something that looks kind of fun to look at, and you can explain a little, you can understand a little bit more exactly as to how these juice jacking malicious kiosks were using, what scripts I was using to pull data from phones and push data to phones. But going back to this, the cell phone bugs, they're basically grouped into two sections. There's malicious base stations, which is Cyclone, Crossbeam, Ebsir, Entourage, Nebula, Typho, and then there's intelligence gathering tools. The intelligence gathering tools were more like hardware, like a physical cell phone. These documents were released a while ago, so it was basically like their hack of some phone so they can use it for software-defined radio, so they can listen to RF frequencies while on the ground, and it just looked like they were looking at their cell phone. That's basically the majority of what they are. They can track cell phones using their cell phone, just look for signals, or they can, one of them, a very popular one was Candygram, which was a cell phone tracker, basically, so they could follow you around, allegedly, if they gave you a cell phone. So again, if you're traveling and somebody from a government agency hands you a cell phone at random saying, here, use this while you're abroad, perhaps if you don't want to be tracked, don't use it. Base stations, though, are an entirely different thing because it's not something that you physically have access to. You'll pretty much never know that a malicious cell phone base station may exist unless you take specific action. Here is a basic idea as to what you would do. There are a lot of, basically listen out on cell phone networks, see what cell phone towers your cell phone may be able to peer with, and have your cell phone let you know if something is new or something is changing. Obviously, everybody, when you move around, your cell phone towers will change. So the point of this type of system would be that you keep one cell phone at your office in a static location. And I assume that cell phone towers don't just pop up and go down, unless somebody's doing something funky with a femtocell or their own rogue network. So that would be a reason for you to be concerned, is to think, what's happening in my area? Perhaps you may find that the cell phone tower that was available at your office is now available at your home, and then it followed you to the hotel down the street in another state, maybe you want to see what's going on. Maybe you want to think a little bit. And now the difference, though, is that you know that there is a cell phone tower for some reason that's following you. I don't have any software to release with this. Again, I built some test code, some proof of concepts. It's a lot of false positives. Especially whenever you start moving cell phones, and cell phone towers kind of turn on and off on their own. So I wouldn't want to be releasing something that freaks everybody out. You have to make sure that the phone stays in a single location and things don't change too much around you. Also, I don't think anybody really needs that, because not a lot of people keep their one cell phone in a static location, except for maybe if you're stuck in an embassy trying to avoid extradition. I don't know how many people there are in the world right now that might want it, but if that guy wants to buy this program, I'll sell it to him. But again, back on cell phones, the main problem is that you do not control your network. You control your device to a degree, but you do not control your network. So you have to remember that once information leaves your hands, leaves your control, you actually have no control over this. And this doesn't stick with just cell phones. This is applicable towards servers, services, cloud, anything, star cloud, anything cloud related. So you have to remember, honestly, I have to give a hat tip and say, remember OPSEC at all times. Operational security, without it, you really will just be toiling in the dark, playing in a playground, and failing to actually detect or know anything. But you will be detected, and people will know what you're doing. If you remember to do OPSEC, it's the best solution here for people who are concerned about these sort of things, especially if you use some of these methods to actually detect surveillance states. Then you want to be sure to apply operational security. And obviously, detecting it will know if your operational security has failed or not. So I'm going to give a conclusion here. I don't know if there were any other questions. Nope. Just please feel free to come up to one of the microphones that are available out there, or find one of the speaker goons. The majority of this was mostly about a thought experiment. It's not, it was really to invoke discussion. Bugs are detectable. Many of the information out there has been out there. It's been discussed at hacker conferences over the years. There's hard evidence, which is best for more so than hearsay. Tinfoil hats are never stylish. Here is the slide for any information for further reading. You can read the exact specific blog post where I go to some more details about the specific types of things that I was seeing. I'll leave this on while I guess there's some questions over here on the right. Yeah?
Yeah, I have a question. Some of the major internet service providers are deploying a pilot where your home Wi-Fi basically becomes public Wi-Fi. How does this change things?
Well, now you're offering service. You're becoming the ISP at your home. Well, how does it change things for, let's say, what, the ISP or for yourself or your home or your worries of liability or being monitored?
Right. I'm thinking more from liability of now you're kind of a access point to people you don't know.
Yeah. That gives you not liability, but that gives you plausible deniability. You can say, I don't know if I was that person or not. This is why I'm not endorsing this necessarily. This is a do at your own risk, but opening up your Wi-Fi to have an open Wi-Fi access point allows you to say plausible deniability. This guy's like, hell no. Absolutely, yeah, it's very risky to do that. Anything can happen once you do that, and you'll have to fight it off in courts, but you'll have some consideration of plausible deniability, especially so if your ISP is the one that's turning it on for other people. Mind you, remember that if the ISP is controlling, if the ISP is giving hardware that controls network for other people on the same ISP or some other people as a Wi-Fi hotspot, they probably also have embedded something on that so they can do remote monitoring and caching. And again, that makes that hardware not your hardware, but their hardware. So you don't own the hardware, you wouldn't be able to make changes or be worried or basically control what's going on. I'll get the one guy behind you because I think it was lined up first and I'll come over to you.
Are most of these tools sort of made by hand by the NSA, CIA, or?
The catalog that was explaining it, basically the question, you know, are they made by hand? Are they made in-house? The catalog that I was explaining it had items available for sale. I don't know if this was the documents were released by a third party that was trying to sell it, kind of like a Sky Mall for all the surveillance actors. But the information on it, though, explicitly stated that the hardware that they're using is things that are available off the shelf. Again, to reference the NSA playset talks, they're using items that are all off the shelf, and you can make effectively the same things by just going to the store, ordering things from Amazon.
Okay.
Yep. And over here.
Is there a reason you're not saying Jake Applebaum's name?
I don't know. I just blacked out there. I couldn't hear who you were talking about.
Well, I guess I did, so that's the credit that's due here.
Yes, Jacob Applebaum was the researcher, journalist who released the information for Der Spiegel. I you can talk to me later about it, especially after a few drinks. I'll be very, very candid. I'm doing it for his protection, not mine. Yes?
Your comments about the TPM chips.
Oh, no. Are you from Trusted Platform Computing?
No, but I am interested in TPM chips, and now we're starting to see similar devices being embedded in mainstream microprocessors from Freescale, Renesas.
Mm-hmm.
Those devices are typically called trust anchors now, and do you see that as something that's going to continue to expand in various hardware fields?
So yeah, is it going to expand? Are we going to continue to see trusted platform modules or trust anchors? I don't know. I can't say. What I do know is that the people who are making these, who choose to pay to install them, are businesses. So they're going to install it more than likely for a business purpose. So they're going to see it. So if it's business viable for them to put it in, they're going to put it into the hardware. If it's not, I'll just be frank, they're probably not going to do it. If there's some awesome thing that made surveillance state actors it makes your hardware impervious to any sort of surveillance, more than likely no major vendor are going to get behind that and make that available on the shelf. But again, it's a two-sided thing. So while trusted platform modules or trust anchors can be used for the manufacturer to protect their investments so they can tell people that this is exactly how it works, hopefully everybody here would know how to break into them, change them to make it so that we can protect ourselves from it. It's going to be a weird give take, and it's going to be between whether or not they have a financial reason to install those chips or help their bottom line.
I've been told that the TPM chips are in many commercial devices today, like iPads. Is that true?
I'm not aware. You can ask somebody from Apple, but I think their answer, I'll give it to you.
They won't answer.
They will not confirm, nor do I. If you get them drunk enough, perhaps they'll answer, but that's very difficult to do. All right, and I don't think any more questions. I don't know if you're going to hunt me down. Afterwards, great. All right, I'm a little early, so... Oh, well, one more question.
You mentioned the software radios for finding RF signals that possibly you don't know what they are.
Yep.
Are there any good open source tools for triangulating them, figuring out where they're coming from?
There's tons of stuff for that. Look up the software-defined radio sites, GNU radio sites, I think it's RT-SDR. I'm forgetting it offhand. They're .com, basically RT-SDR.com. Search Google for software-defined radio. You'll find this group. They do tons of stuff. They all release their information. They talk about how to do triangulations with series, basically antenna arrays, things like that. All that data is all online. I would really enjoy being able to get the time to look more into it myself and give whole talks about it, but there are plenty of resources out there, and that's easily well into the hour-long talk to just even get over the basics of doing triangulation or RF stuff. It is key to note that software-defined radio, I skipped over this in the slide, software-defined radio, your hardware will have a limit. Typically, you'll see between 2 to 5 gigahertz on the high-end. Hack RF is about 2.4 gigahertz, 3 gigahertz. I apologize if I'm wrong, but it's high, but there is a huge spectrum beyond the 3 gigahertz range that if any sort of surveillance tool is happening to work in those spectrums, good luck. I apologize. It will be tens of thousands of dollars for you to be able to acquire the hardware to actually do that detection. Just a fair warning. I'll go over here.
There is actually one last question. Great presentation. You keep making references lately, of course, about having a few drinks and getting them drunk. I'm assuming this is something that you've had experience in the past as far as getting the right information.
I don't know if I was successful or not. I think I got too drunk in the process. Yeah. Go ahead.
Thanks. The tower concept you were talking about, did that cover like LTE S1AP handovers, 4G to 3G handovers, or was it specific to one type of tower handover?
It would be specific to the type of towers that you can...
So you could do an S1AP handover and track that.
Yeah, that goes into, you don't actually own that hardware. You don't actually know what's going on. And also one of the major reasons why I didn't want to release anything that says this is the solution, because cell networks can get way more convoluted and complicated than a simple app on your phone will ever be able to tell you what's happening. Yeah. So
you need to know the S1 MME interface between the eNode B and the MME and all stuff like that. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Right. Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, I'm calling it. Thank you all for sticking around. Thank you.